Welcome to Big Blend Radio's Military Monday Show with Mike Guardia, award-winning author and historian. Hey, everybody. Super excited today because Mike Guardia, as you know, comes on these shows every first Monday for our Military Monday Show, but his new book is about to hit the bookshelves. It is called Fire in the Hole, Tales of Combat with the 1st Engineer Battalion in Vietnam, and you can pre-order it on Kindle by December 7th and by 15th, the Kindle version, and it will be out. So perfect timing for friendly gifts. If you're into military history, especially Vietnam, this will definitely be a book for you, and because it shines light on people that served in Vietnam, and sometimes we forget about combat engineers. So, well, Mike, how are you?
Hey, Lisa, I'm doing great. Always a pleasure to be on the show.
Hey, glad to have you here. Excited about your book. I know we've touched on this on, you know, every show the last few months, just going, okay, is it coming out? Yeah, is it out yet? And there's so much that goes into a book, right? And this is definitely one, you know, telling these stories, and you talk about in the book, how important is that we do not forget those who served in Vietnam, just like we, you know, don't forget those in World War II. But sometimes those who have served in Vietnam are kind of overshadowed, right? And kind of not put in the spotlight as much as we should be putting them in the spotlight and honoring them.
Right. And that was one of the things that really motivated me to take this project on was that, you know, it's been an unfortunate circumstance of history that our Vietnam veterans have not gotten the recognition that they deserve. And it seems that the only recognition they get in a broader sense is the controversy that was attached to the war that they were a part of. You know, it's no undisputed fact that a lot of those veterans came home to a society that castigated them and that they were treated horribly, that many of them were denied entry into their local veterans organizations. And, wow. You know, they were met with, you know, on one end, it was hostility. And I think at best, it was mostly indifference. And, you know, if you take that and compare it against, you know, the hero's welcome that much of the World War II generation got when they came home, you know, it's sad because, you know, if you look at the war from beginning to end, you know, you had what can only be said as the best and brightest of America fighting on the front lines in that war. There's been a trend amongst many popular historians over the better part of 50 years to say that it was a poor man's war and that, you know, we were just taking draftees who were more or less the dregs of society and throwing them onto the front lines in a war that we knew was unwinnable. And, you know, well, you did have a few questionable draftees in there, and you did have a breakdown in discipline towards the end of the conflict. You know, it ignores the broader picture that the U.S. military really carried itself with distinction. And, when you look at how many of these veterans were portrayed by the media in all of the years that followed, you know, just reinforced a lot of the negative stereotypes, and the Vietnam vets were, you know, pretty much a silent generation unto themselves because of a lot of the hostility that they faced. And one of the things that I noticed, particularly throughout Hollywood, and you know, I have said this in other programs before that, you know, when you take a look at how Hollywood has portrayed the normal Vietnam veteran, it's always been somebody who they've portrayed as a misfit in modern society. You know, if you take a look at all the popular films like Apocalypse Now and Platoon and Full Metal Jacket, you don't really see a positive portrayal of the war in Vietnam or even the veterans who fought in it. And I think to myself, even if you take some of the action heroes of the time, you know, if you take guys like John Rambo and Billy Jack and James Braddock, you know, even though they were heroes of the stories that they were in, they were still portrayed as anti-heroes almost. You know, they were these troubled souls who were constantly struggling with their memories of Vietnam. And they themselves served as a case study of, you know, just how bad the veterans had it. It wasn't really until that Mel Gibson movie, Where We Were Soldiers, came out that you really had a reversal of fortunes for the Vietnam vets community. And, you know, we really need to give them they're due because they're starting to die off at rates comparable to what the World War II generation is.
And it's kind of come full circle for you with your books, writing about Hal Moore and, now getting back into the Vietnam War history. Do you think people, because of the Korean War, that at the beginning of Vietnam, everybody thought it was, I wonder how many people, a lot of people forget the Korean War too, right? We've talked about that before. But the beginning of Vietnam, that people thought, okay, it's like the Korean War again. But at the same time, soldiers were drafted. So to come home after being drafted, and some went in wanting to go in and wanting to serve, and some were drafted and wanted to, some were as scared as could be, and some, look at the TV show MASH, they're like, hey, I'm going to do whatever I can to go home. Even the Korean War too, right? And so when you look at it, and the war did change, it's not the what you can't really look at the soldiers and blame them for stuff. I mean, they were also kind of thrust into a war that I don't think they were prepared for, quite frankly. Or am I right or wrong on that? I'm not the historian, you are.
Well, they were thrust into a war that I think was poorly conceived and poorly managed at the strategic level. And you really had a situation that was untenable from the get-go that, even though our soldiers were performing brilliantly throughout every one of the ground campaigns that they were in, had unclear parameters and you had a very solid disconnect between the soldiers who were fighting on the front lines and the war managers from their strategic perches, both in country and in DC. And really what it made for was a situation where you were putting the best equipment and the best soldiers in the field, but you were putting them in a situation where, they could win a battle and they could secure a particular area, but then as soon as they moved out of that area and were going to hand it off to the South Vietnamese, that South Vietnam military apparatus wasn't strong enough to keep hold of the region and to keep it secure under their own power. To say nothing of the fact that the enemy was able to have several cross-border sanctuaries in Laos and Cambodia, and neither of those countries were anywhere near having the wherewithal to, keep the communist influence out.
So let's talk about in your book, you talk about combat engineers, which is, I mean, how often do we hear about combat engineers, really? Like, always talk about pilots, we're talking about, tank warfare, where that kind of thing. So well, we've talked about everything all the way to George Washington. It's like we've talked a little bit about everything on this show, but with your books, combat engineers, I think this is something that, us on the civilian side or those who are not as familiar in military history will actually know what combat engineers do.
And that was another thing that motivated me to take on this project because, I look at all of the popular military history titles and they all tend to fall into one of a few categories. They're either biographies or they're overviews of a particular battle or, they're looking at a particular unit history. Or it's about pilots, it's about tanks, it's about the it's about the paratroopers, it's about the foot soldiers on the ground. And comparatively little attention, I think, has ever been given to what the combat engineers do and the vital role that they play throughout all of our battlefield operations. So for anyone out there who's listening, who's unfamiliar with the combat engineers, they are multifaceted troops who do a lot of different missions on the battlefield. They can fight as infantry whenever they are ordered to. They set and clear minefields. They also build tactical bridges. They also do a lot of route security. They blow mines in place. They were, up until recent years, they were responsible for the removal of unexploded enemy ordnance. They also set obstacles and they also clear spaces for tactical roads and they also clear landing zones. And It's a very technical job that I think, after having researched it and after having interviewed a number of combat engineering veterans, that it's a job that requires a lot of resilience and a lot of technical skills, because aside from everything that I've just described, they also are responsible for vertical construction, which means that a lot of the base camps that get built by US forces, whenever we deploy to any parts of the world, you have the combat engineers who are building those bases from the ground up. They're the ones who are laying the foundations for the barracks. They're building the they're building the command centers. And wherever we deploy, if the infrastructure isn't strong enough to support any one of our maneuver forces, you have the combat engineers who are doing a lot of infrastructure and road repair, making sure that the roads can accommodate any tonnage of vehicular traffic, and making sure the bridges are, you know, of an of a sturdy enough quality to handle handle traffic over various seasons.
That's insane when you think about it, because they're pretty much like the surveyors of the land, right? So they go out and they're on their own, right? They're out there on their own, like you're doing something so important, and you are, like you're saying, laying the foundation, but don't you have to be like super stealth because you don't have anything supporting you in a way, right? When you go out.
It's very hard to be stealth when you're doing any number of these construction projects. And that's why whenever you have an engineering construction team who is out in the middle of nowhere and they're trying to build a bridge, or they're trying to resurface a road, or even if they're clearing mines, you typically have an engineer, or excuse me, you typically have an infantry security company that goes along with them. It can be it can be any type of infantry element that you know, just provides the overwatching security, so that in case the engineers get attacked, there's a rapid response force that can at least keep the enemy held in one place while the engineers themselves can stop whatever they're doing and pick up their own rifles and return fire. And that's
Wow.
part of
So,
this, that's part of what makes the engineers so flexible, is that they have the capacity to fight as infantry on order.
so they can do that. And then at the same time, when you think about these engineers going out, how many would be in, like, it would be like a battalion. Like you talk about, there was Operation Amarillo. We're not talking about Amarillo, Texas, right? You know, this is not Texas, y'all. But when they go out to really, put the foundation together, how many of them go out at one time? Or does that depend on what's going on in the specific battle zone that's about to happen? And doesn't it have to be faster than, depending on what's going on? Like, because things happen quickly. You don't always know what the enemy's doing, right? So, don't things move and change all the time? Even though if you're building something, it could be like, all right, forget it. We're going here instead, and you have to move it.
Well, that's why whenever any one of these engineering units go out, or in the case of a battalion, you usually have different companies within the battalion that are assigned to a specific sector. And it's that company that's in charge of that particular part of the operational environment. And you'll never, or well, I won't say never, but rarely will you see an entire engineer battalion as a battalion in one singular place. Normally the companies are farmed out to different areas. And, you know, if one company gets called away for it, any number of reasons, you can have another engineering asset cover down on them. And a lot of times what'll happen, and this even happened in one instance in the book, where, you know, you had an engineering team who was working on a construction project. You know, they were working on some road repairs, and their infantry security element got called away because there was a firefight that was happening a few kilometers away. And really, that's the nature of the business. You kind of have to expect it, because in that particular environment, you know, the infantry is always the priority. So if the engineers are there, you'll put them in one of two situations where they have to provide their own security, and they just rotate soldiers on and off the line. The project takes a lot longer to get done. or you have some other allied unit that's nearby, try to fill in for them. And interestingly enough, that's a good segue into one of the more interesting anecdotes of the book, where Charlie Company, or one of their road reconstruction teams, was working on a project. Their infantry element got called away, and the infantry unit that replaced the outgoing one was an Australian infantry unit, of all things. And I think a lot of people tend to forget that the war in Vietnam was not just solely an American endeavor. We had a lot of allied partners who were, who were involved in that conflict. And the Australians were among them. And they had a great reputation among a lot of the allied combatants. They said that they were tough as nails and on par with our own special forces. So just try to imagine Crocodile Dundee as a as a soldier in Vietnam, and that'll give you, I think, a pretty realistic idea of the caliber of the Australian soldiers that were out there.
Well, and they know the terrain too. I mean, yeah, Australians are crazy, man. I mean that in a positive way. They are, like, in a really positive way. I wouldn't mess with them. Yeah. You know what I mean? I wouldn't. I just I have a lot of friends of Australian, and it's like, oh yeah, if we're gonna go for it, we're gonna go for it. Just they have like that wild streak, and it's positive, when it's used positively, And we do forget about Australians. So going back into the book, I mean, again, you're always telling these stories of people so we can grasp and understand what soldiers went through, be it male or female, right? A fighter pilot it don't matter. Or a combat engineer. We get to understand what people went through during these wars and battles, and how it's really a huge team effort too. That's one thing we've got to think about, is like, it's a team effort, but Dan Crowley is a big part of your book. Tell everybody about Dan.
Okay. So I met Dan through a mutual friend who is also a fellow author. And, when she arranged the introduction, she said, "Mike, given all of the war stories that you write about, you really should talk to my friend Dan. He's been a friend of mine for about 40 years now. And he was in the 1st Infantry Division back in the Vietnam War." And I said, "Okay, well, can you tell me more about what he's done?" And she said, "Yeah, he was assigned to the 1st Engineer Battalion, and he's got a lot of incredible stories to share about his time when he was over there. And he's in contact with many of his fellow veterans." And I said, "Okay, well, yeah, I mean, that'd be great. I would love to, I would love to hear him. I would love to hear him speak. I would love to meet him." And, he, of course, introduced me to the rest of his veterans. And just an incredible story that Dan Crowley has to tell in and of himself. Here was a man who was a product of the Greatest Generation. He was the first set of the baby boomers who were born to the men who were returning from World War II. And, he very much grew up as a product of the 1950s and the early 60s. Where, it was where nobody's patriotism was questioned. And, every war that America had fought in was a just war. And it was your patriotic duty to serve in some form or fashion. Well, Dan himself had a pretty itinerant childhood. He would often go between Michigan and Florida. And, his parents owned a very large resort property that, had a lot of wooded areas, had a lot of pastoral areas, which really cultivated his love for the outdoors. He also grew up with I think, a very intimate knowledge of farm equipment, John Deere combines and tractors, and how to maintain the pastoral land that his parents owned. And, just aside from that, he also had what started off as a juvenile interest that I will say bordered on slight pyromania, but he was really into fireworks. Matter of fact, he was a young pyrotechnic entrepreneur at a young grade school age, where, he would buy and sell fireworks, and he would also, he would also make his own. And, he would also say that, his love of pyrotechnics would also would also propagate some innovative ways to keep his family fed, because he found out very quickly that he could take a small stick of dynamite, and he could throw it into the local river where a lot of the walleye fish were running deep. And, you know, he would just count down, you know, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and then boom, that part of the river would explode, but it would send up all the walleye fish sky high, and they would land on the bank, and he'd be like, all right, score. I got enough fish to feed my family for a week.
Wow. So he liked blowing stuff up.
No, he did.
Hey, might as well, if you're going to have, you know, fish, let's get on with it.
Yeah,
instead of
exactly.
waiting 10 years. So he was proactive,
he sure was. So right after high school, that was when he decided to enlist in the army. And he said, you know, I'd gotten my draft notice, my notice that I was eligible for the draft, when I turned 18. And being that everyone at that point in time was subject to a 2-year peacetime conscription, I figured, well, you know what? Let me join voluntarily so I have a choice of what I do, and I can parlay some of the skills I pick up in the military to any number of career options I have later. So he decided to become a combat engineer. He went through basic training. He went through his, MOS training as a combat engineer. Of course, gravitated more towards the pyrotechnic side of the house, and he learned how to be a demolitions expert. So as a young private, barely 20 years old, or actually he's still 19 at this point, he does a short tour of duty in West Germany, and he also volunteers for duty in Vietnam. So he says, hey, this is a great real world mission. The war is still very young at this point. I think the true combat mission, quote unquote, is barely a few months old, and he's just ready and raring to get into a place where he can fight for freedom along the frontier of democracy in South Vietnam. So he gets his orders to the 1st Engineer Battalion, a unit that he has up until this point never heard of, part of the 1st Infantry Division. And he says, well, hey, great. You know what? By the time I get there, they're already going to be in Vietnam, so I'll be able to join my unit in country. Redeploys from Germany back to the U.S., goes from the continental U.S. to San Francisco. And he boards a troop ship there. Almost doesn't make it, because through a comedy of errors, he lands in the Oakland Navy brig. On Christmas, no less, on Christmas Eve, 1965.
Wow.
Because one of the Marine MPs who was patrolling the area, sees him in a bar and, pegs him as being too young, quote unquote, to be in a bar at the age of 19, even though Crowley was stone cold sober.
Oh
yeah, but because of the manpower needs in Vietnam, his transgression is pretty much let off with a slap on the wrist, and he's put on the troop ship to join his unit in country. Well, by the time he gets there, the 1st Engineer Battalion has been on the ground in Vietnam for about 4 months at this point, and he's coming in as an individual replacement, and he's trying to learn the culture, trying to learn the lay of the land and how to fight and to come out alive. And it really is a baptism by fire that Crowley has for his entire year in Vietnam, because from the outset, he's put in charge of a number of demolitions. He's given a whole equipment list, a whole kit bag of all these tools and pyrotechnics that are designed to do one thing: kill the enemy, kill them fast, and create a whole lot of damage within a very wide radius of where his bombs go off. And he's going out on all of these demolition teams. At first, he's marching right alongside the infantry, and he's blowing up enemy ordnance that they find. He's blowing out, and he's clearing these Viet Cong tunnels. And that's when he gets his first realization of just how resilient the Viet Cong are at this point, and he marvels at a lot of their engineering know-how. Now, of course, a lot of these tunnels had pre-existed before the Viet Cong did, but he says, just seeing how they mocked everything up, and seeing how they uh, how they structured these tunnels and how they laid them out. So it was impressive, and it was kind of scary at the same time. And not only that, learning how to adapt to the adality, to the realities of fighting in a jungle, fighting in a guerrilla war, says it was a very steep learning curve, because you often didn't know who was a Viet Cong and who wasn't. This was an enemy that lurked in and amongst the population. And sometimes you didn't know if any of these call girls who would come up and solicit a good time with any of these GIs was actually a Viet Cong spy. And you had to be careful of who you associated with in and amongst the Saigon population, because you didn't know if somebody who pretends to be your friend one day could turn out to be a Viet Cong informant.
Wow. So, because they were working all sides, right? It's kind of, that's kind of crazy, because I think that's where the general public, like American general public, didn't quite understand what was happening. You know, you mentioned how when soldiers and veterans came home that, you know, people were calling them baby killers.
Right.
And I don't, you know, yeah, there was issues, right? I think it was a war that actually, you know, from what I've read, you know, and is it could drive you up the wall, like literally you're out fighting in this heat, you know, the bugs, the, you know, and you, 1 minute you think you have a friend, like you're saying, and then they're not. And you, when you get hurt or trapped, you're hurt. You're in, you know, you're in a jungle, and it's crazy. And at the same time, it's like, you don't know who to trust. And so I think that's what, when things happened, villages and women and children were hurt along the way. You know, that happens in every war, you know, regardless, it does. I mean, look what just happens, you know, with Hamas, right? You know, with hostages and all of that. As much as, you know, there's the international thing of, you know, protect the women and children, that's not what happens. Really, at the end of the day. So do you think that's part of it with the baby killers, is that, you know, people would trust people and find out they can't, and you know, then start to realize that you think that everyone's the enemy when maybe they were. You know what I mean? Where you just kind of like you can kind of freak out not knowing who's around you. And
Exactly. And, you know, that's one of the things that they wrestle with a lot, is, you know, just not knowing exactly where the enemy is going to be on any given day. And, also just fighting the hours of boredom. You know, two of the veterans, I think, outlined this very well throughout the course of the project. Both Dan Crowley and Chuck Humphrey commented on this in some form or fashion. But, you know, you have a tour of duty in Vietnam that can be best described as hours and hours of boredom interspersed by moments of sheer terror, because that was any number of the ambush patrols that they went on, where they would lay in wait. They would set these claymore mines. They would set these explosives. They would set all of these booby traps for a Viet Cong patrol. And they could go out every day for a week, and every night that particular week, no enemy would come into their sector. And then, you know, 2 days later, they set an ambush patrol, and, you know, they get like three enemy patrols that they ambush within the span of one night. So it really was a hit or miss affair. And not only that, they said that on any number of these convoys that we went on, some of the convoys, you know, you had the, it seemed like the primary mission of the convoy was to just draw fire from the enemy and to see if you could smoke them out. I mean, of course, you know, the convoy had a destination, but, you know, the secondary mission that no one would talk about would be, okay, well, let's see how many IEDs that we can run into today, and see if we can draw fire from the enemy. And, you know, if we can uncover another cache, then we'll consider that another step closer to victory. And Larry Blair, the company commander, he commented on that as much, because you would have a patrol that would hit a landmine. And he said, you know, the irony is that IEDs were something that were around long before the war in Iraq and Afghanistan ever started. You know, the Viet Cong had it pretty much had the IED the whole IED concept down to an art. And they would set up these command wire detonated devices in the middle of the road, and they would
Wow.
specifically position them to where they would fall underneath where a vehicle would be the most vulnerable, and they would time it to detonate it where the softest part of the vehicle would be. And they said, sometimes the mines would work, sometimes they wouldn't, but you would dig these things up, and you could follow the command wire back to the position where the bomber had been. And usually by that time he had split the scene, but you were able to gather up, some intel that would lead you closer to wherever the local VC cell was.
Wow. So the engineers were like the ground warriors, pretty much,
Yeah, they really were.
Wow. So, and that's what I was saying. We just don't always hear about them, and how much, I mean, they put their life on the line because, yeah, back then it's not like we have like a button on a cell phone to blow stuff up. Everything was wired. And what about backup supplies for the engineers? Was that an issue for them?
Well, it was simply because of where we were in the timeline, when the war was when the war was new, and we were trying to get troops into theater as quickly as we could. There was often a backlog of supplies where you needed C4, you needed Claremore mines, and it wasn't always that easy to get them, especially when you needed them. But the dirty little secret that everybody knows but nobody really discusses is what we call the supply chain mafia. And that is, if you know the right people and have connections to any one of those network of supply depots that are in country, you can use those connections to get what we call priority access to any one of the gear items or any one of the essential items that you need. And of course, it's also a well-known fact that things are, as they say, quote unquote, tactically acquired. This particular depot here was left unattended. Well, I'm a soldier and I certainly need this piece of gear. I don't think anyone's going to miss it if I just five finger this little piece of C4 right here and take it with me on a mission. And but then of course you leave that particular supply unit short in the books on C4 that they can't account for.
Wow. So that's things that people need to know, the general public. What else do you think when you were doing this investigation, like the investigate the research, but I feel like you're an investigator, when you're going through this, did you find anything that, kind of raised your eyebrows that maybe we just haven't been told in history books and in media and, obviously the movies do what they want to do, right? They paint their brush the way they want to paint it. But did you come across things that you're like, because you're a teacher, you're a historian, but did you find something that went, oh man, I didn't know that. This is what they were going through.
Well, there were a few things that really, really jumped out to me. One of them was the fact that very often the local bazaars in Saigon could get top quality supplies at cheaper prices than they could get from their own supply depots. That really struck me as interesting. And also something that struck me as peculiar was that a lot of these local bazaars would have World War II vintage equipment for sale at bargain basement prices. And the regulations at the time didn't prohibit soldiers from buying, these secondhand older generation weapons and actually taking them out on missions. It's like, okay,
No
well,
way.
it's like, yeah,
Really?
it's like, oh, of course. Yeah. So, you'd have a soldier with his M16 assault rifle or the few units that were still using the M14 at that time. Well, if he goes to one of the local street vendors in Saigon and, is able to get like a World War II era Thompson submachine gun for only like $2.50, plus he can buy like a whole month's worth of ammo for that gun for only 10 bucks. He'd be like, yeah, hey man, that's a great deal. I'll buy this old GI machine gun. I'll take it with me. And, yeah, it'll be one more thing that I have to kill the enemy with. So that was a very pleasant surprise that I uncovered because, yeah, just thinking, Based on my own experiences in the military, is like if the weapon or the piece of equipment was not issued, if it was not per the AR-670-1 regulations, they're like, no, soldier, you get rid of that. You can't have it.
Right.
So that was one thing. And another thing really that struck me just as it struck me as interesting, really just in its anecdotal form, was just a lot of the war stories that both Dan Crowley and Larry Blair had to share, particularly of moments where you just have to think to yourself, truth really is a lot stranger than fiction sometimes. Because there was the episode that Dan Crowley told me about of where he was in placing a minefield, and you had this one wacko GI who, despite the fact that it was very clear that there was a minefield being laid in front of this guy, tried to navigate his way through it. The whole setup of the story is that they had cleared this one section that was adjacent to one of the base camps, and they were setting a minefield around it as a protective measure. Well, Dan Crowley, as one of the demolitions experts, he was working with the battalion executive officer to try to set this landmine field, or excuse me, to set this minefield in place. And they had fenced it off with barbed wire. They had put warning signs all around it. And then out of nowhere, this one random GI who was also assigned to Dan's unit comes into view, and Dan sees him out of the corner of his eye. And he's thinking to himself, how the hell did this fella get in here to get to where he is now? He would have had to have shimmied through like four different strands of barbed wire, and he's emerged unscathed. But this one GI is not only smoking a cigarette, he's got a transistor radio on the other hand, and he's just gingerly going along, like he doesn't have a care in the world. So Dan, he yells out to him, "Hey, stop, fellow, this is a minefield. You're gonna have to go around the other way." And the GI just like stops in his tracks for a moment and is, I guess, tries to contemplate the situation. And for one reason or another, he just gets the wild idea to take off running. And hey, I think I'm just gonna run my way through this minefield and see if I can John Wayne the whole thing. Well,
Wow. Seriously.
Murphy's Law being what it is, this guy, of course, steps on a landmine. And the landmines are still clearly being marked at this point. There's a stake that's by almost each and every one of them. And he steps on a landmine, and the landmine just happens to be a few feet away from where Dan Crowley is. So the landmine blows the foot off the poor GI, and the blast
Ooh.
or the shockwave of the blast is enough to send Dan Crowley into a somersault.
Wow.
Dan lands with barely enough consciousness left, but by the time he regains his senses, somehow having despite taking a somersault, Dan still has the detonator device in his hand. But he gets up, he has this intense ringing in his ears. Of course, he's just been way too close to a blast. But he sees the GI who is not only missing his foot, but despite the fact that he's not missing or despite the fact that he's missing his foot, he's still crawling across the minefield to try to get to the cigarette that he dropped when the blast blew his foot off.
What the hell? Are
And
you,
Dan's thinking, yeah,
dude?
and Dan's thinking to himself, oh my God, fella, you just tried to run across a minefield. You just had your foot literally blown off. It's been severed off of your body, and you're trying to save your cigarette for a few more puffs before it gets down to the butt. What the hell is wrong with this guy?
Yeah.
Dan said that that one episode is the thing that haunts him the most out of his time in Vietnam. He says, because I still can't figure it out. What was this
Yeah, I
guy's
wonder if he had
problem?
malaria. If, like,
Yeah,
if
I
he
mean, I was wondering
delusional
if it
from.
was, whether it was like some undiagnosed mental condition. Was this guy just a Section 8 that was waiting to happen? Or,
Yeah.
was he trying to commit suicide? Was it some kind of other disorder that was just scrambling his brain?
I
But
think when you're in so much heat and humidity and you don't know who to trust, and it, yeah, I think it can just get to you. I really think it can, you know?
So Dan lost his hearing, I think, for the better part of a day, and his hearing eventually
Oh.
returned. But he said even to this day, that episode still gives him nightmares, and I can't blame him. I really can't.
I wonder about, hearing for those who have been to war, you know,
Yeah.
because even just cannons, like I've filmed like cannons being shot often, no matter what I do, I'm like, I jump and I don't care if I'm got a tripod or not, man. I'm going down. I don't care if you're putting earbuds in or not. I mean, that sound, it's loud.
It
I mean,
is.
it
It
really
is.
is loud.
Yeah.
And
I mean, I mean, even from my own experiences as a tank commander, it, and even with the ear protection we have built in to our CVC covers, yeah, when you hear that gun go off, I mean, it is loud as all get out. And, what really shocks you more than the sound of the gun going off is the shockwave itself, of the blast. 'Cause, you know, if you're even within a good 20 meters of a tank when that main gun fires, oh man, the concussion wave, that will knock you right to your feet. It really will.
You could, well, things like that go through your body, and that also creates your body to make sound, your blood and everything moving. Adrenaline makes a sound, you know. That's it's yeah, I mean, it I think eventually, like for some people, it can, that's where I say that guy could have, you know, something could have just ticked him at that point, you know. But that is crazy, you know, like just for a cigarette, you know, maybe he was scared. He was like, I'm going down, so I need to smoke, you know, or maybe he had more things in that cigarette than we know, you
Could
know.
be,
He's like, dude, if I'm going down with my foot, I'm going to be happy. You know, who knows? Who knows what was going on there? And what about drugs? You know, that's what everybody's talking about, you know, that, you know, guys out there fighting were high a lot. Do you think, what about that? Did you come across anything on that when you were researching this?
Well, no, I didn't hear any stories explicitly from Dan or from any of the other veterans about any of the experimental drugs that were circulating around Vietnam. I mean, I know that they were at the time, and I know that I know that I know that marijuana was very prevalent at the time, and in a lot of places in the military, it actually still is. But the one drug I know, and I'm just speaking in generalities when I say this, is that I know that the one drug that caused irreparable damage for a lot of soldiers in Vietnam was LSD, because you know it wasn't like alcohol or it wasn't like marijuana, because if you drink alcohol, you get drunk, your faculties will re return when you sober up, and if you're toking the reefer, same difference. Whenever you come off of your high, that's when your faculties return. But taking an acid trip, if you are dropping LSD, that's going to alter the neurophysiology of the brain. And, you could be stone cold sober for 3 years afterwards, not even touch the stuff. And then, at random, boom, you sail out on another acid trip. So, so that was a big thing for, soldiers who were in Vietnam at the time. LSD, and it's kind of ironic that if it wasn't the illicit drugs that were harming their health long term, it was Agent Orange, which was the defoliant that we were using.
Yeah, Agent Orange is terrible. And I interviewed a lady, Rita Kopelinski, and she's passed since. And it was about Agent Orange, and her husband went to war to Vietnam, and they had married right before. And he came back and had, you know, been affected by Agent Orange, but it didn't really get him. And it actually affected her, and her child. So it went from him to the child. And so the child was born, had all kinds of issues, autism, you name it. And then it went down to the next child. So it's kind of this weird thing how it does these just generational changes. And she went to Congress. She did so much. And and also got to that point, I think, where there's like a paranoia that can happen when your family is affected by something so traumatic as that. That not a paranoia, but it like a you're obsessed with it. You know, your passion can turn to obsessiveness, you know what I mean? Where you cannot let something go because it's that unjust and it was that terrible, which I understand. But like she remember interviewing her, and she's like, "Are you near a railroad?" I'm like, "Yeah, actually, there's a railroad down the street." She's like, "You need to get away. People should not, because Agent Orange has been, carried by railroad, by certain things." She's like, "People should not live in these places because it splashes over and you'll get it." And she really thought it helped, created a lot of the autoimmune issues that we have now because of the environmental effects. And then you've got to think about how it was tested in Hawaii. I mean, they sprayed it over Hawaii as testing grounds. We've done shows on it, and all kinds of things where, it wasn't popular to do when we did. And that stayed in the ground. And we have a friend who did soil tests with scientists, but it not just, "Hey, I'm out there with my eye microscope," like real deal stuff. And how it did actually affect the water table, it affected agriculture. And all of this happens all around the school. And then it went into agriculture that's not too happy too, because it's all owned by the same company. Very crazy story, but yeah, it's still there. And they, Agent Orange is still around in different forms. And it's a scary thing. And I think it's still in. We have a lot of, families with a lot of medical issues that are still kind of unknown. And I'm wondering about that generational skip and how it goes through kids, maybe not the people that were right there, but how it does that to what are the effects that we're feeling now in society that we don't realize goes back to Agent Orange, I'm not trying to be like an alarmist or, a conspiracy theory or anything like that. I think it's a genuine thing that, we have going. And but yeah, she wrote a book about it, and it was crazy when you start really reading, and what her husband how her husband's personality completely changed when he came home. And and she and they were totally in love and happy, and not afterwards. It was very difficult, and especially with a child back in those days. So she was almost like a single parent in a way. But and her husband passed early, I think, too, as I recall, because of it. But it didn't affect her, which is interesting, but it affected her child, how it went through that. So yeah, there's so much about what everyone went through in Vietnam and with the drugs. I think that was just the culture at the time, and people didn't realize how bad it was for you at that point. Not yet. I mean, we had the reefer madness thing, right? But at the same time, like, look at it. It's legal now. Weed is just not as big a deal as people. Well, it depends on what you're doing, right? I don't want to, push anybody into drugs or anything. It's not my call. But I think at that time, it's like cigarettes weren't a big deal, back in the day. And now we realize how bad it is for our health. But I kind of deep down think, don't we all know when you're doing something like that to your body that you can feel it? Don't you think deep down,
Maybe you do.
But if it's a
I think
comfort.
there's, well, I think the biggest thing that you feel at the time is a sense of relief and a high that wasn't there before. I mean, people talk about natural highs. Well, if you take like that biggest natural high and you try to replicate it in a chemical sense, you just want that good feeling. You want that feeling of euphoria. It's either that or you want something that's going to dull the pain that you're feeling at any given time. And, I think in a broader sense, that's why a lot of people turn to alcohol. And, you have all those songs that say, oh, this bottle is my only friend and I find happiness at the bottom of a glass of Jack Daniels or whatever. It's that, I guess I want to call it a neurodepressant or even a neurostimulant, something that,
Like a numbing agent, because, like, you
yes,
think about
exactly.
it, being out there in the jungle and all this stuff is happening, right? It's crazy. And you're like, there's fear, no matter what. I don't care who you are. There's fear in there. It's a good thing, and it's a can be a bad thing. But so LSD could just heighten what's going on, like, and make you trip out bad. So now I wonder about that guy, if he, but then he would he be able to go and pick up his cigarette again So that's a wild story, Mike.
Yes.
That's
Yeah.
crazy. Like I, dude, no way. I mean, just even going over the landmine, like, just growing up and learning about limpet mines and things, like, that was a real deal in Africa about, mines. And in this country, like, it was so weird to come here and come home and people didn't know what the heck we were talking about except for military people. We get along with military people. They understand. Like, we're like, okay, you have to be careful where you could go walking out anywhere in Africa and you could blow up and it's just a mine that was there or, but I mean, in Asia, they still have mines out there, right? In like Cambodia and stuff, right? They still are detonating these mines. And
We still got them in Afghanistan.
really?
Oh yeah,
Oh.
a lot of mines. Oddly enough, a lot of minefields, from what I understand, from from back in the days of the Soviet war.
Really? So you never know if they could just detonate, or do you think they just die off over age?
Well, that's the thing. There's always there's always the chance there's always a chance that the detonation that the de that the detonator mechanism is always going to stay intact. It's been they have found and force detonated mines that have been upwards of 50 years old. So
Growing up too, we also learned about hand grenades, and those are scary, scary, scary things to me. Hand grenades, and that they were around in World Wars too, right? World War II, World War One,
War two,
yeah. So in Vietnam as well, right?
Of
Hand grenades,
course.
like, oh my gosh, like, are we still using them now? I know, and
Oh yeah.
that was some,
Yep,
no
we
way
still
in
have hand
hell,
grenades.
like that would be. I have a hard time putting on, house alarms, turning them on and off. That would scare the, what out of me to hold that. I mean, even, what I mean? To go through even that training of knowing that you have to pull this and throw it and not do it at the wrong time, or like, could they just blow you up out of like suddenly something, it got too hot. The M&Ms don't melt, but your hand grenade's going to blow up. Could it just out of like a malfunction, just blow up on you?
Well, not as long as you have the safety pin inside. Once you pull
Oh,
the
yeah.
pin, once you pull the pin from the grenade, now the grenade, you can still keep it from going off as long as you keep your hand on the clip. As long as you keep your hand fully, as long as you keep your hand fully depressed on top of the clip itself, if you pull the pin but your hand is still on the clip, the grenade won't go off. It's usually you have about 5 to 7 seconds after you let go of the clip, then that what and then that's what's going to arm the mechanism for it to explode. But once you take your hand off the clip, that's it. It's
But
like,
okay, so like, I throw balls for dogs, right? And
yeah.
biscuits and stuff, and I get laughed at quite a bit, and the dogs often look at me like, what the hell was that? Like, that was not a good throw. That sucked. Why is it on the roof in the gutter? Why is a dog biscuit under the chair? Like, why didn't you do that? So, like, you better be a good thrower, right? You got to be a pitcher to do this, to be able to throw a hand grenade. I mean,
Well, kind
you
of.
don't want to drop it, right? Like, holy cow.
So, there's a whole block of instruction that that every soldier goes through in basic training, where you have to learn the fundamentals of how to employ hand grenades. There's actually a hand grenade assault course where they teach you the proper employment. They teach you how to properly keep it stored on your person. And then when you use the hand grenade, there's a certain technique that you have to use in order to throw it. They show you this technique. It's comparable to throwing a baseball, kind of, but they show you the mechanics of it to try to get the most range for the grenade. And there's even a jingle that I remember that they teach you whenever you're about to use it. And it's a jingle for a three-part process. They say first thumb the clip, or yeah, they say let's see, it's oh no, I'm sorry. It is proper grip, thumb the clip, twist, pull the pin, and throw.
So you get to remember that, and you better. Now,
Yeah.
what about the combat engineers? I would. Would you think that were hand grenades used quite a bit? Because,
Oh, of course.
they're on the ground, and that would be something that sometimes it might be quicker to grab than a gun or a rifle
Well,
or.
I wouldn't say that it would be quicker to grab, but it would be a good tool to use if ever you feel like you're pinned down or if you want to try to facilitate a better advance towards something.
Oh, like so you could de you could like toss a grenade, let it blow up over there so they think you're there, and then run the other way, kind of
You could
thing.
do that. You could do that, or you could throw the grenade to, say, theoretically, a squad of enemy troops, and then that grenade blast will probably kill any three soldiers that are within a 20-meter radius of it. And then, as you know, and anybody beyond that 20-meter radius is going to have a bad concussion and ringing in their ears. And you can use that tactical delay to move forward to another forward covered position and maybe lay down fire or, you know, facilitate killing of that entire enemy squad.
I just think the combat engineer thing is hardcore. Like if you're building bridges and stuff like that, like I mean it's because you know that a lot of times you're going to be in like in some kind of valley. It kind of feels like cowboys and Indians, you know what I mean?
Right.
Like
It sure
they're gonna
does.
like pounce you, you know what I mean? And they know their terrain better than our soldiers would ever know, you know what I mean? So that had to be like just really, like you're always looking out the back of your head
Exactly.
for people. So, I mean, because we didn't have all the technology we have now. Did we, would you say we had better training in technology than after World War II? Like we were better prepared in some ways because
Oh
of,
yeah. You know
yeah.
what? The training that we had at the time and the technology we had at the time was much better than where we were in December of 1941. I mean, yeah, there was more of a reliance on strategic retaliation by the late 1950s and early 60s. So, I mean, you had more of the defense dollars allocated towards, you know, like strategic missiles and NORAD and whatnot. But you know, the training at the soldier level and the tactical competence of our troops was still head and shoulders above where we were or when we started out at the beginning of World War II. And you see that played out time and again in so many of those opening battles of Vietnam, you know, where we were just mopping up the Viet Cong left and right. You know, I mean, people forget that we won every single ground battle in Vietnam, and
Yeah.
we killed over 2 million North Vietnamese, and we won the war, and we had even won the peace at first, but we ended up throwing South Vietnam to the wolves when the North Vietnamese, you know, invaded in 75.
Good memory for people to
Yeah.
have. A good reminder, not a memory, but a good
Right.
reminder, of what happened, Ah. I know it's crazy. And I think like Jane Fonda really pissed people off,
Of course.
people, I think she apologized later about that. But it kind of like once every, it, what a wild time to be alive, right? To, people and, fighting. And then at the same time, it was the hippie time. I mean, it was just this whole, yeah, I'd put the word, yeah, it's a little crazy, a very
It
mixed bag of the world, but it was a good era for music,
Oh,
I
yeah,
think.
it sure was.
That was a good era for music,
Yeah, no arguments
and
there.
how, what, I know helicopters were, used in World War II, but do you think this was like the era of the helicopter?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, this really was the first conflict where helicopters really came into their own. You know, I mean, helicopter warfare is what it is today, I think largely in part of what we did and what we learned from Vietnam.
And Hal Moore.
Of course, yeah.
Got to bring him back into that.
Yeah.
Well, Mike, again, congratulations on the, how many books now before I get it wrong? It's in the 20s,
Yes,
22,
this
23.
actually makes 26 now.
Oh, now I obviously I can't keep up or count, but 26, that is awesome. That is awesome. What's coming up in 2024?
All right. In 2024, two books. One is Red Bandit, the Combat History of the MiG-29, and another one called Sarajevo at Dawn. And that is about the spy war in Bosnia back in the
Wow.
mid-90s. Yeah.
That's a little close to home, you
Yeah.
know? Yeah, it's, I feel like everything's cycling, you know, these cycles keep spinning around
Right.
and we're right back to where we were, you know? And I wonder about that if veterans sit back and go, dude, we already fixed this and now we're doing it again, you know? It's like, you know, policies, you know, you fight for something, it becomes a law and then it gets taken away. And it's like, that's the way it is. It's interesting what happens in the world. It's humans. Humans do things. Everyone, MikeGuardia.com is a website to keep up with Mike, but I encourage you to go to Amazon. Go to Mike's page on Amazon. That's where you can pre-order his new book and get his other books. Great holiday gifts. The book is Fire in the Hole, Tales of Combat with the 1st Engineer Battalion in Vietnam. And that, again, you can pre-order it December 7th on Kindle. And people can gift Kindle copies, right, to
Of
people.
course, yeah.
Yeah. Just saying, if you didn't get that shipping, you got a shipping problem. This is a good thing. And Kindle and paperback versions will be out December 15th, so in time for the holidays. So check that out. Go to his Amazon page there and also MikeGuardia.com. Mike, we're looking forward to the new year with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Lisa. Always a pleasure to be on the show.
Thank you for listening to Big Blend Radio's Military Monday show featuring Mike Guardia, award-winning author and historian. Keep up with Mike and his books at MikeGuardia.com. Follow us at BigBlendRadio.com.